Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kari Hong, and I represent petitioner Yasu Flores Peralta, whom I will refer to as Mr. Flores.
Welcome back. Discuss...
Thank you. Nice to see you again, sir. I will discuss competency, reason to believe, and then cancellation. The easiest way for the court to resolve this case is to recognize that the BIA and IJ erred in upholding a competency finding that happened without a psychological evaluation. A year later, we had one that documented that Mr. Flores had cognitive decline from Alzheimer's. In the motion to reopen, the BIA claimed it wouldn't reconsider the competency hearing because a year later, the IJ had found him competent.
May I ask a really threshold question here, and that relates to exhaustion. In the government's brief, in a footnote, they note the difference, of course, between admissibility in terms of an alien seeking admission and then inadmissibility, and say that the seeking admission was not exhausted and nothing was responded to in the reply brief on that. Why wouldn't we deem that issue not exhausted?
Your Honor, the motion to reopen mentioned that the prejudice arising from not having a hearing with counsel was that he wasn't able to fight this inadmissibility argument. So it wasn't exhausted under the direct appeal, but it does come in through the motion to reopen as a prejudice factor.
I'm not quite sure why that would come in, because that we don't really have ineffective assistance of counsel on the table, do we?
Well, Your Honor, was in terms of the motion, the reason for the motion to reopen, in order to show why the BIA never disputed it, but they said there was no prejudice because he would have lost anyway. And the showing is that actually, if he did have a new hearing, he would have both been able to fight the admissibility ground as well as provide more equities in support of the prior grant of cancellation.
Well, I guess I'm distinguishing between inadmissibility and admission as an alien. And so that's where I think that we're crossing paths and not speaking in the same terms here in terms of your answer. So I'm asking really about the argument that the admission as an alien, or seeking an alien seeking admission is actually the technical term, where that was exhausted.
And Your Honor, just for clarification, is that about the reason to believe argument?
Yes.
The question is
It goes to that, but of course, if you distinguish between the inadmissibility, which was considered below in terms of the BIA, but the alien seeking admission was not considered.
Yes, Your Honor. I apologize. I misunderstood. Starting at page 16 in the opening brief is my best answer to show exhaustion on that issue. Now, the BIA did address the general matter regarding the inadmissibility.
Correct.
And
but not the not the alien seeking admission issue.
Correct, Your Honor. And then that would be the general versus specific.
I don't know why you say general versus specific. I guess I'm still having some trouble understanding, because those are two very distinct grounds and very distinct statutory provisions.
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Flores had argued to the BIA that there were sufficient evidentiary defects in the record to contest his inadmissibility at the threshold, unquote. And that's at page 32. I would argue that, although inartful, is enough to put this on notice to then allow counsel's more specific argument that I raised in the brief that refers to what Valenzuela Felix then talked about in terms of that there has to be something more in the evidence to uphold the reason to believe. And Your Honor, would you like me to continue with competency or just jump into the reason to believe since we're there?
You're welcome to go where you think it's most important.
Okay, so Your Honor, back to the competency issue, which is the easiest to resolve, because again, it's a cleaner case. It was exhausted. Is that the BIA said that the new evidence can't be considered because a year ago he was found competent, but the psychological reports show that there was a decline. That at one point he had average intelligence, and now he had his functioning was measured at the 47th, 27th, and 12th percentiles. The BIA wrongfully speculated that he could not have been impacted a year ago from that decline, but without evidence, Calderon-Rodriguez requires this to be sent back for a new competency hearing and allow him to present that evidence there. The IJ also erred in denying a continuance that was made in a timely manner before his when he was before him. Mr. Florence requested a 6-week continuance with a named psychologist who had a specific appointment and had been retained by the Florence Project to meet with him and evaluate the competency. The DHS did not oppose it. Under Garcia Lynch, the IJ's denial of that continuance was error. The missing evidence was material, as we later found out, that he had impairments. Mr. Flores was not at odds for the conduct. Part of the delay arose when the DHS moved him between facilities in different cities, which prevented him from getting a medical report earlier in time. This was the third extension request, or continuance request, but it was unopposed. So the Garcia Lynch is a separate reason to then have a new competency hearing.
Is he in custody?
Not anymore. He was released just recently because of the COVID situation.
So he's been in custody for over 3 years?
He was released.
But before that.
Correct.
How long was he in custody for?
Your Honor, I don't have that exact information. I could look it up for the rebuttal or provide it to the court later. But it was a lengthy period.
Was there a finding that he lacked knowledge, or arguably a finding that he lacked knowledge, before one of the IJs?
Yes, Your Honor. On that issue, that goes to the reason to believe argument, which I think is something very important here. This case is exactly what Judge Berzon predicted could happen, which is we could have an absurd situation where an LPR is going to be deported for a crime that a prosecutor reviewed and determined actually did not occur. So to your question about what the finding of knowledge, when in the first inadmissibility hearing, which happened in January 2018, the IJ there, IJ Knopp, looked at the incident report, noted that in that incident report he denied knowledge, and noted again, she said, "Sir, I hear that you are denying your knowledge again," but nonetheless upheld the inadmissibility ground. Under Gomez-Granillo, she needed to have been directed to show that if she credited his denial, that she cannot uphold the reason to believe standard. The second time that he was before a different IJ at the actual merits hearing, again, the IJ cut off cross-examination of him on that issue by noting that the I-213 was hearsay, and unless she was planning to bring in the officer, he wasn't going to admit it, and said that he has already denied knowledge of the marijuana in his van. And then finally, in his actual decision, when the IJ granted him...
Right, he said there's no evidence of knowledge.
Well, it's an ambiguous situation. In his finding, the IJ said he denied knowledge. The IJ then never commented further. I think at a minimum, that's ambiguous under, again, Gomez-Granillo, that the IJ needed to be directed, that if he believed his denial, that he then needed to vacate and undo the inadmissibility finding that the first IJ had made. I also think that you can read that to say that the IJ credited it. But again, that's an ambiguity, but I do think there's enough there. The fact that he credited, mentioned, and then never imputed guilt to him is a reasonable inference. But under Gomez-Granillo, the ambiguity enough is enough to reverse that.
So you're arguing that, just to clarify, that there should be a remand to address the competency issue?
Yes, there are a number.
And what does that mean in terms of how this progresses?
What would happen? It would vacate everything. He would have a new IJ hearing if he's found competent. The prior, everything would be reinstated. If he's found incompetent, then there would be a new proceeding.
When you say everything would be reinstated, you mean we're sort of back on appeal, dealing with some of the core issues that we've been discussing already?
Your Honor, if he's found competent, nothing more would happen. The existing decision would be reinstated without an appeal. If he's found incompetent, he would have the benefit of counsel to fully contest the inadmissibility ground, which would be a basis for termination, and further bolster the record to support the IJ's initial grant of cancellation.
Well, one thing, I hope I'm not taking too much time, but the BIA made a reference to reversing because of they felt that the IJ didn't appropriately consider the severity of the offense. You recall that?
Yes, I do, Your Honor.
And I don't understand that statement, because the issue isn't considering the severity. It's equally, at least, whether he had any knowledge of the drugs at all. So help me understand what that reference means.
Your Honor, I agree with your reading of that. That's my third point, that the BIA engaged in improper fact-finding. That the IJ, that the BIA can review factual findings, but has to do so under clear error. What it looked like the BIA did is that instead of actually reweighing the factors that the IJ found relevant, that the BIA made its own findings, primarily that the incident actually was a criminal matter, versus what the IJ had concluded wasn't serious, because he appears implicitly to accept his denial of the knowledge of the drugs there.
But would you would agree, though, if we read it differently, that the BIA is not essentially overturning a factual finding on clear error, but simply reweighing the facts, that would be proper for the BIA, correct?
Yes, if the BIA is reweighing a list of factors and comes out on the other side, they're allowed to do that, and there's no review before this court to make any correction or change to that.
Do you want to reserve your remaining time?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Sarah Bird on behalf of the government. This case is about whether or not the board abused its discretion in denying a motion to reopen. It did not. The motion to reopen was premised on an allegation that the pro bono attorney who represented Mr. Flores on appeal to the board provided ineffective assistance of counsel. And the board rationally denied the motion, finding one, it wasn't ineffective assistance, but then two, even if it was, it wasn't prejudicial because the outcome would have been the same. And then also finding, with regard to the new evidence, that also wouldn't have changed the outcome. So this really comes down to an abuse of discretion decision, whether or not the board was rational in explaining why it denied the motion to reopen. With regard to the allegations of ineffective assistance, petitioner is basically arguing that his attorney, who defended the immigration judge, because keep in mind that he won before the immigration judge. The immigration judge granted him cancellation of removal, and he was poised to walk out of court with a green card. in place. So he actually, if you look back through the record, he did an excellent job presenting his case. He consistently denied the allegations in the notice to appear, contested removability. He presented hundreds of pages of evidence in support of his theory that he wasn't inadmissible, and also in support of his application for relief. And then the immigration judge granted his application. So that's the posture that it was at the point that his attorney came on board. And his attorney argued that the board should simply affirm the grant of cancellation. That was not ineffective assistance. That was a reasonable tactical decision. Now, in hindsight, after the board reversed, he now wishes that he had said, my hearing was fundamentally unfair, I didn't have due process. But those are all hindsight arguments as to why what he thinks his attorney should have argued on appeal.
Let me ask you on the exhaustion question, because I'm not sure that his counsel actually engaged with my distinction between an alien seeking admission and the inadmissibility. And it does seem to me that inadmissibility was fairly exhausted. But what is the government's position with respect to alien seeking admission, whether it was exhausted and whether it would have made a difference in how we look at the case?
Yes, Your Honor. Our position is in the footnote that you referenced in the brief, and it is, we draw the same distinction that you're drawing. So I agree that in the motion to reopen, he raises the reason to believe ground of inadmissibility. That was before the board, and the board addressed it. But what he did not raise was the whether he should have been considered seeking admission, an applicant for admission under Section 1101, I believe it's A13 or some C13, but under the definition section of the INA. And that statute, he didn't engage with that. There are now six bases for a returning lawful permanent resident to be seeking admission. And while he contests the idea that he was inadmissible, one of the bases for regarding a lawful permanent resident as seeking admission is that that person is inadmissible under one of the 212 grounds. And that is the reason to believe ground, and he did address that. But there's another basis, and that's just that he engaged in illegal conduct after leaving the U.S., and there's no dispute that he bought cocaine. He testified that
I understand the distinction between alien seeking admission and inadmissibility, which I think that was conflated in his brief. But if we agree with the government that the alien seeking admission prong was not exhausted, how does that fold into what we still have left for decision under inadmissibility?
Okay. Right. So we would agree that that's not exhausted. Still left for decision is the reason to believe whether substantial evidence supports the determination that there was reason to believe that he was involved in trafficking. Now, that is there, but it's under the umbrella of the ineffective assistance of counsel. He didn't directly raise that, but it came in under the allegation that his attorney was ineffective for failing to file a cross appeal. Instead of just, his attorney argued you should affirm the IJ decision, and he's arguing in hindsight his attorney should have cross appealed. So with regard to the reason to believe, I think one key issue that I want to emphasize is that the immigration judge, in the immigration judge's decision, clearly finds true, and the immigration judge uses that word true, allegation number 5 in the notice to appeal. So this is in the context of a paragraph with the title removability, and then the immigration judge acknowledges petitioner Mr. Flores had denied that he knew about the marijuana, but then says that the judge found true allegation 5 in the notice to appear, which is the allegation that he did know about the marijuana. So there's no ambiguity in the immigration judge's findings of removability. The immigration judge knew that it was a decision of, do I credit his claim that he didn't know about it, or do I find that he did know about it? And the immigration judge found true the allegation that he did know about it.
But there's no there's no explicit finding in the IJ's determination that Flores was aware of the presence of marijuana in his van, correct?
No, sir. That's it. I actually would say that there is an explicit finding that is explicitly what Allegation 5 in the Notice to Appear says, that he attempted, Allegation 5 in the Notice to Appear is that he attempted to bring marijuana in, and an attempt requires the knowledge, and the immigration judge explicitly found that true. Now, what we don't have is the immigration judge explicitly saying, therefore, having found that he knew about it, I find that he's not credible in his denials. We don't have an adverse credibility.
I mean, isn't it a problem to have sort of check the box justice? You know, there's no record at all, just a statement of true based on an allegation. We don't know what was considered. We don't know what connections were made. We don't know anything about it. And that just seems like a dangerous road to go down.
But well, Your Honor, we do know the evidence that was considered. The evidence showed that he was nervous when he arrived at the port of entry, that he did deny having anything, that there were anomalies in the van that he owned and drove. He was the owner and sole driver of the van, and
knowledge is the most knowledge is such a fundamental attribute of this type of dispute, because what goes on at the border, people do become unwittingly duped to do things. They do have a situation where a family member has a gun at their head and they're told, you know, take this across or there's going to be trouble. I mean, I've seen all of those things as a district judge. And, you know, to say that somebody is nervous when they're crossing the border, well, he had some personal use drugs, for sure. But, you know, again, I've never been a fan, and maybe it's just me, of this sort of demeanor type of approach to creating guilt or innocence, because there's so many unknowns with personalities and why people react.
Certainly, Your Honor. I think the nervousness just gave them reason to continue searching. And then they tapped and they found the anomaly. So we're not resting solely on that. And at the end of the day, this type of case is going to come down to he denies that he knew it was there, but there's all this evidence. And
okay, so then what does reason to believe mean under the context of has committed? Those are very different standards, as Judge Berzon pointed out, you know, years ago.
This court addressed that in Lopez Molina, the 2004 case, and you're referring, I believe, to the has committed in 1252A2C?
Yes.
Of the statute? Yes. So this court directly addressed that in Lopez Molina and said that because 1252A2C and the jurisdictional bar there refers to the grounds in 212, and the reason to believe is one of those grounds, that it's encompassed. And it wrestled with that difference between has committed and reason to believe, and it came out with the determination that although there are some differences in the phrasing, that the reason to believe ground is enough to trigger the jurisdictional bar, and that it therefore applies. So, of course, this court can still consider jurisdictional facts, which in this case are the main factual issue is the reason to believe, and the court can still consider that. But if the court finds that substantial evidence supports the reason to believe determination, then the jurisdictional bar would be triggered. Now, keep in mind, of course, that that's under the umbrella of ineffective assistance of counsel. So,
To be circular, but how can you find reason to believe if there's lack of knowledge? You know, the drug trafficking component, you know, defines drug trafficker. I don't think anyone's going to argue that this guy was a trafficker. He seems like, at the most, he was either a knowing, aiding, and abettor, or he just didn't know. So what's more pivotal to this whole analysis than knowledge? And what evidence do we have of knowledge?
We have circumstantial evidence, Your Honor, and that's all. It's his word that he didn't know, which anyone who's caught is going to say they didn't know, mostly, versus the circumstantial evidence that he was the owner and only driver of the car, that he never loaned it out, that it had hidden compartments built into it where he had a very large quantity, over 100 pounds, of marijuana, And it's just circumstantial evidence. So I agree with you that if the immigration judge found that he did not know as a fact, then they couldn't sustain the charge of inadmissibility. But the immigration judge found true the allegation that he did know. So we have an explicit finding that he did know, and the board affirmed that, well, affirmed it in the context of the motion to reopen. And so then it just comes down to, do you, at this stage, does the record compel the conclusion that he lacked knowledge? And it really is, it's just his word against the circumstantial evidence. And it's a tricky case, but it's not compelling. It's not, it's the same as the evidence in Alicorn Serrano, I'm probably mispronouncing that, where that petitioner also denied knowledge. And this court said that there was substantial evidence to support based on the circumstantial evidence.
So Lopez Molina is a jurisdictional case, but didn't Judge Berzon explicitly state that the applicable standard question is different?
In which case? I'm sorry, Judge Berzon wasn't on Lopez Molina.
Right, in her subsequent opinion. I don't have that.
As far as I know, Lopez Molina remains controlling precedent, and I don't know which Judge Berzon opinion you're referring to.
Maybe it was an unfair question then.
I'm sorry. I would address it if I knew, but I just, to be honest, don't have enough context to know exactly what she meant. But really, in this case, the reason to believe is part of it. As to the competency petitioner raised, again, that comes in only if the court first finds that it was ineffective assistance of counsel for the attorney to not cross-appeal and say that the petitioner was deprived of due process in a case he won before the IJ. And then, also, if you look at it, the IJ reasonably found the record doesn't compel the conclusion that he wasn't competent because he did present consistent, well-argued denial of removability and application for relief, and his application for relief was granted. So, while he subsequently was found to have dementia, and that's a tough diagnosis, that doesn't show that at the time of his hearing, based on his interactions with the judge, he wasn't competent. And there is no legal requirement that the judge always has to order or continue a case to allow a forensic or psychiatric evaluation. The judge is allowed to make a competency determination based on evidence in the record, which in this case did include medical notes from a psychiatrist that he had visited in DHS facility. So the judge is allowed to make that competency determination and is not required to constantly continue for more evidence. If there are no further questions, I see I'm getting low on time. There's a lot of issues here, so I don't want to start on one.
No, I mean, it appears there are a lot of questions, but we also have extensive briefing on everything, so it appears there's no further questions.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We turn to the Flores Peralta's counsel, Ms. Hung.
Thank you. I have 4 points. First, the attorney at AR 84 said he was brand new to immigration law. This is his first immigration case, and after being confronted with the errors, agrees that he made a mistake in his appeal. Second, to answer your question, Judge Pregerson, Chavez-Gonzalez is the case you were referring to, where Judge Berzon said that there should be something different when a returning LPR is subject to the reason to believe. That is the has committed argument that I raised in the brief, that Judge McEwen, when you asked whether it had been adequately exhausted, I'd made my best case if I didn't convince you. However, I would highlight that the inadmissibility and the reason to believe standard is still under review.
And I agree with that. I mean, that was clearly addressed by the BIA.
And so if the court disagrees on the has committed, what's unique about this case is that every other reason to believe case, that Alcaraz Serrano and Gomez Granillo, there was evidence. The DHA has to prove something, and they did. in Alcaraz Serrano, there was an express disbelief that the IJ denied, or that the IJ did not credit the denial because they believed that because he had bought the car 4 days before from a known drug dealer, he was in on the scheme. Under Gomez Granillo, there was an expert. Here, there's nothing other than the denial, which the IJ at AR 201 noted when she upheld the reason to believe standard. And so for that reason, I submit that even under the reason to believe standard, this is a low threshold that fails to meet it.
Thank you. I just wanted to clarify, Ms. Hong, when you're listed with the law school there, does that mean that the students wrote the brief?
Not this one, no.
This
one was mine.
All right, thank you. The case just argued, Flores Peralta versus Garland, is submitted. I thank both of you for your arguments this morning. The last case on the calendar, United States versus Scott, has been submitted, so we're adjourned for the morning.